Our next talk is by Philippe Chouard,
who will speak about consciousness and more specifically projectivism and the problem of temporal experience.
Right, so I'm going to, is it too loud? Going to try to address these issues from a philosophy of perception perspective. And two things strike you at first when you look at this literature on consciousness of time and perception of time is that, first, a sociological fact, an awful lot of metaphysicians are writing about what their experience of time are like, and very few philosophers of perception say anything about it. They seem to be quite shy about what these experiences are like. Not much to say. Second thing is, when you are like me, if you're a newcomer to that topic, there's lots of things going on, and there's lots of very confusing things going on, and lots of different issues that seem to be there. So what I'm going to do today is very modest. First, I'm going to try to say why there's something interesting from a philosophy of perception perspective about experiences of time, and what really is, if there's any deep philosophical problem about experience of time, where that problem lies. And then second, I'm going to sketch a solution to that problem, which is a very familiar solution, in fact, but I just want to defend it a little bit. So the first thing, the problem, we seem to perceive time or have experiences of temporal properties. Why is that philosophically interesting from a philosophy of perception perspective? And secondly, the solution. There's something funny going on often in the literature on perception of time, is that the dialectic is often set up in a certain way. So people start up with a very simple-minded account, and then they offer a barrage of objections against this account in order to motivate more complex views and try to show what's the right account. And I wanted to try to suggest that we can just stop with a simple account, that it works perfectly well, and so that this sort of dialectical motivation for other views is not going to work. Right. Okay. So what's the problem? Well, there's a general issue about how we have access to temporal properties and how we know time. Of course, there's plenty of ways in which we know time. We can just look at our clocks or watches, and we can decide that it's 25 to 12. But that's kind of interesting, but maybe it's not that interesting. It seems as though we have some other kind of access to time. We have some kind of consciousness, not via clocks or other things, of certain temporal properties. And so then there's the question, what is the nature of that access? So you might think, well, there's something that's non-perceptual about our consciousness of time. Maybe we have some kind of internal clock in our brain that sort of gives us a measure of the passage of time. And that's a very, very interesting question, probably quite complicated question, but it's not going to be the issue I'll address today. I want to focus on sensory slash perceptual access we have, or we might have, to time and temporal properties. So when I mention temporal properties, there's a question of, well, what kind of temporal properties do we have access to? Actually, I've got this thing. Does that work? Yeah. What kind of temporal properties? Well, when looking at the metaphysics of time, we know there's at least two kinds of temporal properties. There's what metaphysicians call the A properties, or sometimes they call the A predicates, but it's supposed to be about metaphysics, so I'm going to talk about properties. And so there's things like being present, being past, being future. And this gives rise to a famous problem in the metaphysics of time, which I'll call the translation problem. And I'm going to suggest that from a philosophy of perception perspective, it's not such a big issue. Okay, so how does the issue arise? Something like this. We have these two theories of time, and they differ, as you know, this should be all well known. They differ along two dimensions, at least. So the A theory makes a claim about the existence or the instantiation of a certain kind of properties, the A properties, so events can be present, past, and future, whereas the B theory denies that there are such things. They say there's only B properties, which are usually the paradigmatic cases, are relational properties or relations, such as being simultaneous with, being non-simultaneous with, being earlier than or later than, that sort of thing. And then there's a second dimension of disagreement, which is often the A theory says that time is dynamic, and most B theorists think that time is static. So that's the dispute. And then there's a kind of ontological difference between these two views. The B theory has only B locations, however we actually capture those, and maybe dates hour something else, so like being the 4th of July 1977, and there's B relations of being earlier than, later than, simultaneous with. That's the ontology about temporal properties. And the A theory has also B locations and B relations, and on top of that, they have A properties like being past, present, and future. Okay, so that's the two views, and then there's this problem, which is a problem for the B theorist, allegedly, which is how can they account for the sorts of experiences we seem to have, i.e. experiences of the present, for instance. So, for example, I throw this in the air, and my experience seems to represent that event as an event that occurs right now, an event that's present. And if that's the case, well, presumably there's a challenge for the B theorist how to explain these sorts of experiences. And there's usually two options to answer that problem. One is just go for a narrow theory. Well, it just turns out that experience misrepresents reality. The nature of time is a deep metaphysical issue, and there's no good reason to think that perception is going to give us an answer to that question. And so we might think that, well, it just turns out that experience misrepresents the nature of time. And maybe that's not such a high price to pay. Lots of people are prepared to make such a move when, for example, they talk about the metaphysical color. It seems as though experiences represent colors as having a sort of sensory quality, a sort of reddish feel over that object. But physics tells us there's no such thing out there in the object. It's merely maybe just spectral reflectance properties, that sort of thing. And so experience kind of misrepresents red object in a certain way. That's the first move. The second move is the translation move, which is, well, you can deny that really experiences represent event as being present rather than something that's kind of a counterpart of presentness in B terms. So you might think you have an experience, PE, representing with a content that E is present, and in fact, the B theory is going to say the right account of that experience is PE has a content that E, the event, is simultaneous with this experience I'm having right now. And on this view, you don't have massive error, but you don't have an experience, the content of which carries an ontological commitment to A properties. And then there's an issue as to how to decide between these two passings of the content of experience, and usually people appeal to phenomenology, but I find it very hard to decide on phenomenological grounds which one is the right passing. Intuitively, it seems that the B passing is just as plausible as the A passing. And when someone, you know, comes and says, no, really, the A account is the best account, I just want to walk away. Okay, so the translation problem, kind of interesting. We know what the moves are. But from a philosophy of perception perspective, these moves are not that controversial. So what about the other kind of properties, the B properties? Things such as being simultaneous with, being later than, earlier than, succeeding in a certain order, and duration, and that sort of thing. Well, they give rise to what I call the problem of temporal experience. And first I'll say a few things about what sort of thing might give rise to that problem. Well, the following kind of experiences. Right. Okay. That's the only justification for doing PowerPoint, I guess. So in that case, you have an experience of a succession of events. I idealize a bit. Let's say we have three events. We have the event of the little guy coming down with a certain noise, then staying in a stationary flight for a little moment, and then a third event of him going away. All right. So we have experiences of the succession of event. And that seemed to involve representation of the following kind of properties. So first of all, these three events are perceived as being non-simultaneous. The little guy coming down is earlier than the little guy having the stationary flight, which is earlier than the little guy flying away. They're also perceived in a given temporal order. So one is earlier than the other, and blah, blah, blah. Okay. And they have a certain duration. So each event is perceived as having a certain duration, and the whole sequence of events is perceived as having a certain duration. And interestingly, you can have variation along these three dimensions. So, and this is harder. PowerPoint's a bit limited. So this is... let's say we have these three events being experienced simultaneously. You can't do simultaneous things with simultaneous animations with PowerPoint, apparently, or I haven't found the way to do it. Different order, or different duration, so it kind of takes him a bit longer to go through. Right, okay. Right. So, you know, variations in the ways in which these three properties that constitute experience of succession are represented. Okay, so the intuition when we think about these experiences is that we have an experience that represents the events. They represent the events as being non-simultaneous, in a certain way, i.e. in a certain order, and each event has a certain duration, and the whole sequence has a certain duration. Okay. And so it seems the issue is to how we explain these sorts of experiences. One fairly nice way in which
to put the problem is that we can ask the question, what figures in the content of experience? So we can ask the question, well, do colors figure in the content of experience? Do shapes figure in the content of experience? Do computers figure in the content of experience? Do protons and electrons figure in the content of experience? And do temporal properties like these figure in the content of experience? There's a bit of idealization going on there because, of course, I am putting the question this way. I'm committing myself to a representationist account. And one worry is going to be, first, that there might be some very liberal answers to these questions if you're doxasticist about experience. Doxasticists think that experience is just a certain, experience is identical to having a certain inclination to believe. And because you can believe lots of things, then, of course, lots of things are going to figure. That would be an easy answer. And presumably we can try to suggest that, you know, something a bit more substantive about the question so we can rule out the doxasticist move. There's lots of objections to this view anyway. A second worry is that some people don't like representationalism. There's a recent apparently sexy view which is called naive realism again, which is something like a commitment to direct realism. We perceive things directly. And second claim, there is no representational content. And so we need to translate this question for the naive realist. So this is why I had present in brackets, because they often talk that way. So there's no content, but there's a sense in which in experience you're directly presented with these sorts of properties. That's going to be the way to put the question for them. All right. Okay. Now notice that, as I said, these temporal properties are B properties. Being non-simultaneous with preceding, you can give a B language version of these properties. If that's the case, then whatever the problem is, these sorts of experiences don't seem to raise any distinctive problem for the B theory. That's not going to be the issue, unlike the translation problem. Secondly, notice that A theorists agree that there are B relations and B locations, and so it's not going to be a distinctive problem for the A theorist either. So now, who is it a problem for, and why is it a problem? How does the problem arise? Or maybe there's no problem. It's just that there's a phenomenon, and there's just a dispute between two different kinds of views to how to explain that phenomenon. But I think there's something a bit more interesting going on. I think there is a slightly more substantive problem. And the problem arises because of a bunch, at least four assumptions. I only had two on the abstract, but it turned out it's a bit more complex than I thought. Four fairly innocuous assumptions that people make in the philosophy of perception gets you into trouble with these sorts of experiences. Here's how. So I'm going to go through the assumptions and explain how the problem arises. The first assumption is an assumption about particularly about these sorts of experiences of succession. It seems as though what goes on in these cases, assuming that the experience is veridical, so you have the little guy here flying down, staying stationary in the middle for a while, and then moving away. So you have a succession of events that are represented. They're represented as being non-simultaneous, and if the experience is veridical, they are non-simultaneous. And they appear in certain order with a certain duration. Okay, but there's something going on in the experience as well. It looks as though while this thing is happening in the world, your experience changes as well. Your experience, or at least the content of experience, changes. You represent the little guy at location over there at this certain time. And then later, the experience represents the guy in the middle in stationary flight. And then later, it represents
the little guy on the left, or yeah, that was on your left, flying away from the screen. So there's a change in experience, and there seems there's a kind of correspondence or match between what's happening in the world and what's happening with the experience. So that's the intuition. There's a matching assumption. The succession of experience in some way, and the matching is supposed to be sensitive to the temporal properties. The matching represent the events in the world. Okay. So that we think if the experience is veridical, to any change in experience corresponds a change in what happens in the world. So something like this. You have experiences or maybe temporal parts of a single experience, and they change over time in the same way, with the same order and duration as the events change, if the experience is veridical. Okay, so that's the first assumption. It seems quite plausible that something like this is going on when you reflect about the this sort of experience. The second assumption is what we can call the presentness assumption. It's the idea that whenever I experience a certain event, it seems as though the experience represents the event as being right now, or as being as present, but of course you can give the B version of that as being simultaneous with this experience, or there's lots of moves you can make about how to pass this content in B terms, but something like this is right. There seems to be, the experience seems to represent the event as taking place at the same time as the experience itself takes place. This is not saying that it's actually right. It's just the way the experience represents the event. It's not necessarily the case that the event is in fact taking place at the same time as the experience. We know there's a kind of time lag. It takes time for the information to come from the object to through the retina and be processed by the brain, blah, blah, blah. But at least it's the way things appear to us when we have these sorts of experiences. The last two assumptions are even more mundane and innocuous, it seems, and they're really all over the place. And they're just assumptions about how to individuate types and tokens of experiences. The first assumption is the content individuation assumption. Usually we think that one way in which to individuate types of experiences is in virtue of their content. So if I have an experience of Dave over here, representing Dave in a certain location in the room with his facial properties and his bodily position, and I have an experience of Hugh over there with his own facial properties and his bodily position and his position in the room, these experiences have different contents, and that seems to be sufficient ground for thinking they have two distinct experiences and distinct types of experiences with different representational contents. If intentionalism is right and there's a tight connection between content and phenomenology, that's, in a way, that's all we need for individuating types of experiences, because phenomenology doesn't give us any extra criterion for individuating types, but maybe it does. The second assumption is about tokens. Usually, we think that time gives us a way to individuate experiences. So suppose I have an experience of Dave again, but it happens that I've put some drugs in your coffee and you're all paralyzed right now. I walk away from the room, I come back in 3 hours, you haven't moved at all, and I put myself right here again and I have the very same experience I had 2 hours ago, but presumably it's a different token experience. They just don't happen at the same time. Experiences are events and they are qua tokens, they're individuated in terms of their when they take place. Okay, so I guess you can see where this is going. The worry is going to be that we can't really make sense of these four assumptions when we assume that we have experiences of temporal properties, like B properties. Right, so the matching assumption, the idea that there's something, when you have an experience of a change in the world, there's something changing in your experience as well. It's a kind of, maybe it doesn't entail, but it provides some support for a certain account of what goes on in these sorts of experiences. I'll call it the dependence account. The idea is in virtue of that match, in virtue of that correlation, in a way, that experience represents the succession of events. So there's a succession of experiences, you might say. In fact, each experience represents a single event, and the succession of experiences matches the succession of events, and that's how the succession of events gets represented. So in the case of the little guy, you have an experience of the little guy coming down, then another experience of the little guy being stationary, then the third experience of the little guy moving away. And it's that succession of experience and the fact that these experiences match what happens in the world that explains why you have a representation, or it seems like you have a representation of temporal properties. But then there's a problem. If that's the right view, I've just said there's three experiences, one of the event over here, one of the event of the stationary guy, and one of the guy moving away. But then it turns out that no experience actually representing the temporal relations between these three events. It's just a succession of three experiences. And so if that's right, it turns out that we don't in fact have experiences of temporal properties, B-temporal properties, succession, simultaneity, non-simultaneity, and that sort of thing. Maybe simultaneity at least is the thing we'll perceive in that case, but we won't perceive all the others. So it turns out that there's very few B properties we can perceive, and maybe simultaneity is only one of them. Okay, that's not a very pleasant result, because usually we think if we can have knowledge of B properties and B relations on the basis of experience, it has to be the case that experience represents these properties to us, and then we can form beliefs on the basis of these experiences. Okay. Right, so maybe to avoid that unpleasant conclusion that no B property is represented in experience, aside from simultaneity, maybe we need to resist what I call the dependence account. And this is what Michael Tye does in his recent book. So there's first a classical move people make. It's a familiar mistake. You don't want to confuse what's represented in experience and properties of the experience itself. So we don't think that an experience of red has to be red. Likewise, maybe we shouldn't think that an experience of succession has to itself involve a succession of experiences. Second move, well, when you think about beliefs, you can have beliefs with the content that event V1 is earlier than event V2, which is itself earlier than event V3, which is itself earlier than event V4. And you can have that belief in an instant. And you can have it at a time which is different from the time at which these events are taking place. And so there's no matching between the content of the beliefs and the belief itself and what it represents. And why not think that's precisely what's going on with experience too? So we're going to have to view something like this. You just have experiences with a certain content where an event is represented as being earlier than another. And that's all there is to it. Very easy. The problem with this is, well, first, it doesn't really pay justice to the phenomenological intuition I started with, because on this view, there's no need to have this match in phenomenological change of the experience and change of what's going on in the world, because you could have, if that view is true, you could just have a unitary experience, a durationless experience representing the change, and no change in the experience itself. The content is fixed, and so is the phenomenology. But that's a bit weird. And more importantly, that account seems to clash with the other assumptions we've made, or the other assumptions I've made. So start with the presentness assumption. There you go. So there's two options. Assuming that an experience represents, whatever it represents is represented as being present. There's two ways in which the experience can represent these events. It represents two events simultaneously, or it doesn't. Suppose it represents events simultaneously. So the experience represents event V1, it represents event V2, and it represents event V1 as being earlier than event V2. But the problem is that if it both represent these events as present, presumably they are also. It follows that they're represented as being simultaneous, but also the content of experience should represent them as being non-simultaneous. Then, therefore, the content of experience is contradictory, or at least is incoherent. There's something funny going on. And that's very unpleasant. One way to avoid this is to say, well, it turns out that, in fact, the experience has duration, and it doesn't represent these events at the same time. If you say that, there's a bit of a question as to when, for example, it represents the relation of non-simultaneity. But more importantly, because of our last two assumptions, the view is going to collapse into what I call the dependence account. So on this view, you have one experience with duration, and at one time, even V1 is represented, and later in the life of that experience, even V2 is represented. So you have temporal paths of experiences, one of which represents V1, the other of which represents V2, but then these temporal paths have different contents. The first temporal path represents V1 as being over there, the little guy is to the was to the right of the screen, and temporal part 2 represent the little guy in the middle of the screen, different contents. that should tell us that there are different kinds of experiences. And secondly, also, there are different temporal parts. They occur at different times, and that tells us there should be different tokens, experiences. Okay. And if we plug in these two assumptions, it turns out there should be, in fact, a succession of experiences with different contents because of these two assumptions. And if that's the case, then what I called, if you agree with these two assumptions, then it seems that you're driven back to the what I call the dependence account. There has to be a succession of experiences with contents, and there's a change in the contents which suggests that there's distinct experiences succeeding one another, and that's how succession of events gets represented in some way. Okay, so the reason why this these sorts of experiences seem to be interesting is first, but the four assumptions I've used are fairly, as I said, I think are fairly innocuous. You can find them everywhere in the philosophy of perception, if not explicitly, at least implicitly. And the dilemma is that on one view, it turns out that in fact we don't have experiences of temporal properties. On the other view, it turns out that the contents representing these experiences seem to be incoherent. So there's a couple of moves we can make. One is to say, no, of course we can try to reject one of the assumptions, or we can try to suggest that there's a way out. We can grant the four assumptions, but there's a third account which avoids the two horns. Or we can embrace one of the horns and say, well, that's not so bad after all. And that's what I'm going to do, the third solution. So I'm just going to defend the what I call the simple-minded account, because it's very simple, for one thing. And second, it looks a bit too simple sometimes. So the view is something like this. You have tiny experiences, temporally tiny experiences, with different contents occurring at different times, succeeding one another in certain ways. There's certain relations of coherence and similarity between their contents. And it's true that no single experience represents any temporal properties, except, of course, for simultaneity, maybe. But not the other ones. So that's basically the view. And then this question, how to explain... it seems as though we have experiences of succession. The view says, no, we don't, in fact. Well, how to explain that? And this shouldn't be a surprising move. We just have to go projectivist. But what is that? In the same way as people go projectivist about color, they think that... experiences seem to represent these chairs as having a certain kind of reddish sensory quality. That's a property, in fact, of the experience, which is projected onto the chair, but there's no such thing in the world. There's four kinds of projectivism, in fact. This is maybe the only really original part of the paper. You have what I call first-order projectivism. So an experience has a certain property. It's a property of the experience. F, that it has it whenever it represents an object O. And what happens is that the experience in some way projects that property onto the world, onto the object. And in virtue of that projection, it represents the object as being F. That's first-order projectivism. Second-order projectivism says, well, it's true that the experience has that property whenever it represents an object O, but in fact it doesn't. The experience itself doesn't project the property onto the world, and it doesn't represent the object as being O. It's just that subjects of experience think it does. They take it that the experience represents O as being F, but that's actually a mistake. So it's second order because it involves some kind of beliefs about the experience. Then usually when people talk about projectivism, they think that it's some kind of error theory. So in the case of color, usually you think that, well, if physicalism about colors is true, there's no such thing as a sensory quality out there in the world. It's just merely reflectance properties. And so when the experience represents that chair as having that reddish sensory quality, that actually is a case of misrepresentation. That's the way projectivism usually goes. But you don't need to think that's not mandatory. So you might think that whatever mechanism serves to project a property of the experience onto the world and represent an object as having that property, that's just a kind of representation mechanism, and it turns out that these properties, in fact, really exist in the world too. Or maybe they're not quite the same properties. They're, sort of the same way the red stands to red prime, so it's something, a kind of worldly counterpart of the property of experience that's out there. So a question, which kind of projectivism do we want in that case? Well, as I said, if the simple-minded account is true, no experience, in fact, represent temporal properties, b-temporal properties. They don't represent succession of events. And so, presumably, second-order projectivism is the right thing to do. It's not that experience, in fact, projects a property of itself onto the world. It's just that we think when we have succession of tiny experiences, we just form, well, when we do, we tended to form the belief that we've had an experience of succession, but that's wrong. What we've had is a succession of experience, which, and each experience represents a single event, which happens to be in a succession of events. All right, so something like this. There's a succession of experiences, each representing an event in a succession of events, V1, V2, V3, and the subject takes the succession of experiences to represent a succession of events, and that's false. So we have false beliefs about experiences, but not necessarily false beliefs about the world, because if the experience are veridical and there's no funny business going on, then it turns out that there is a succession of events. So there's no misrepresentation there. It's only false beliefs about the experience, but on the basis of the succession of experiences, we can, it seems, nevertheless maybe have true beliefs about the world. There is a succession of events out there. Okay, and then this is how it works. So how does it represent? How does non-simultaneity get represented? Well, mainly the third thing here is crucial. It's just that the events are represented non-simultaneously by a succession of experiences. It's funny. It awfully sounds like a kind of adverbialism at that point, but I don't think it is. What's going on? Sorry. Well, again, how does order get represented? Well, the succession of experiences appear in a certain order and represent the events in a certain order. And that's how it seems as though we get these representations, perceptual representations of order. Likewise, for duration, it seems as though an event has a certain duration. That's just the duration of the succession of experiences representing that particular event. And for the duration of the whole sequence of events, that's just the duration of the whole sequence of experiences representing the events in that succession of events. Okay. Right. So that's basically what the view says. And now, why is it interesting to defend that view? It's often the case, but though not always the case, that many people who work on this approach the subject in that following way. They start with a simple-minded account, and then they bring a whole, as I said, a whole batch of objections, which are supposed to be lethal, and then this just motivates adoption of a more complex view. And I just want to show that the simple-minded account, in the way I spelled it out, can answer these objections. And so that sort of motivation for a more complex view is not going to work. All right. So two famous phenomenological objections to the simple-minded account. Notice, by the way, I'm going to talk to this at the end of the paper, but notice that I haven't talked about memory as yet. And usually the simple-minded account, the broad view, there's an appeal to memory that plays quite an important role in this account of experiences. And I haven't mentioned memory at all. And I'll say later why, in fact, we need memory. I don't think we need memory in the way that people usually seem we do on the simple-minded account. Okay, so two fairly usual objections. It seems as though we have an experience of a relation of non-simultaneity taking place between two events, and there's no explanation for how that's the case, because the simple-minded account doesn't posit any representation of that relation. And so, what's going on? Question. How can we explain the appearances if we don't help ourselves with representations of the temporal relations? The second objection, which I think Barry mentioned, is a worry about fragmentation. On the simple modern account, you just have a succession of tiny experiences, and the only relation there are between them are relations of temporal contiguity and also certain similarities in their content. But the worry here is that that allows, that either entails, I'm not sure how strong the objection is supposed to be, either entails or makes it at least possible that there is no such thing as the phenomenal flow. So I think I have a picture, something like this. Right, so this is a sort of smooth and continuous phenomenal flow of experience of a succession of events of the little guy moving down. And this is the fragmented version. Of presumably the same succession of events, but different. Assume that it's just a different experience of the same thing. But the second experience is fragmented. There's just gaps in between, whereas the first experience was quite smooth. And the suggestion seems to be that if you have the simple mind in account, either that's just possible or it's always the case that there should be fragmentation of this kind. And that's a bit of a mystery because there doesn't seem to be fragmentation. So what's going on? Well, I think fragmentation is possible. In fact, it's quite possible that in some cases there can be temporal gaps between our experiences, and these gaps are large enough for the succession of experiences to appear gappy. But it doesn't have to be always the case. And here I'm going to apply, another famous move. And by the way, I owe this to one of my students in St. Louis who pointed out the similarity with what I went on to say and what Dennett says about the blind spot. So the reference to Dennett is due to him. There's something going on in that dispute about these phenomenological objections to the simple-minded account, which should remind you of what was going on about issues about filling in relation to the blind spot. So the data is like this. There is a blind spot in your visual field, which is explained physiologically. The fact is that in your retina, there's the optical nerve, and where the optical nerve is, there are no cones and rods getting information. So that's the first bit of the data. The second bit of the data is that in most cases you don't notice that there is the blind spot. It doesn't seem as though there's a blind spot. You've got, even over there, that's my blind spot where David is. I can see David. Okay. So it's not that there's a gap in my experience where the blind spot is. So what's going on? How to explain the fact that there's no information at a certain retinotopic location, and yet it seems as though there's information going there in experience. So one kind of explanation, which we can call constructivist, is to say that, well, what happens is that the visual system looks at the information around the blind spot and kind of extrapolates and reconstructs the part of the visual field that's in fact which doesn't get any information, but it sort of represents this by extrapolating from the information surrounding the blind spot. That's the constructivist story. And Dennett says, no, that's not needed. All we need to say is that the visual system simply ignores the fact that there's a blind spot. There's no reconstruction of information going on. It's just that higher level of processing in the visual system just don't notice this absence of information and pretend that it's not there. And so what's true is that you just fail to notice the blind spot. Something like this. It seems that we can have the same kind of explanation for these presumably gappy temporal experiences. And I'm not saying there are gaps. I'm just saying if you think there should be gaps, and there doesn't seem to be, and that's a problem, this is the explanation why that's not a problem after all. It's just that in cases where the gaps, if there are any such things, are small enough, and the contents of the different experiences in a succession are coherent enough, you just don't notice the gaps. Okay, so that's the explanation. Small enough, there's a certain pace to the succession of experiences, and the contents are coherent enough, then you won't notice any gaps. If there's any change in 1, 2, or 3, So you get really a sort of slow succession of experiences. So bloop, the experience of the little guy to the right. Then a couple of seconds later, bloop, the experience of the little guy to the center. And then a bit later, bloop, the experience of the guy to the left. Then that's going to be gappy. That's a failure of the pace of experience. Or if there's a change in the content, if the contents are not coherent enough, it's going to be gappy too. So if you have an experience, very fast experience, a little guy there, and then he's moving there, and then back again, and then things are changing in a kind of spatially incoherent way, then maybe that experience phenomenologically will seem to be gappy. Notice an important point being made here is that there's really two things going on. There's the phenomenology of the experience, which is really nothing but the phenomenology of the succession of single experiences. And then there's a question about epistemic access to that phenomenology. And the explanation is to say that the phenomenology may be gappy, but when it doesn't seem to be, it's just that we fail to have proper access to these gaps. Okay. And that gives us a kind of explanation for answering the no explanation objection. Well, we don't need to be constructivist to explain that smoothness of experiences. We don't need to posit any experiential relation of any kind to explain that. First of all, in any case, there's no experience of succession on this view. It's just succession of experiences. And second of all, the way in which the experiences succeed one another is sufficient to explain the appearance that there is a succession of, there's a represented succession of events, and secondly, that representation seems to be smooth. Okay. Quickly. So that's, in very hand-wavy lines, the way the explanation is going to go. What about memory? What do we need memory for? As I said, insofar as the phenomenology seems to be concerned, it looks as though maybe we can explain the phenomenology, or the apparent phenomenology, in two ways. First of all, the phenomenology is nothing but the phenomenology of the succession of experiences. And second of all, we just make mistakes. We think that there is experiences of succession where, in fact, there's only succession of experiences. But why do we need the memory, then? We don't need the memory to account for the phenomenology. The phenomenology is nothing but the phenomenology of this succession of tiny experiences, i.e., the phenomenology of the first experience added to the phenomenology of the second, and that sort of thing. We need memory to explain our beliefs about the experience. As I said, the best way to defend the simple-minded account is to appeal to second-order projectivism. So the projection that's going on is not that the experience projects anything, is that we have false beliefs about what the experience in fact represents. And you might think that the reason why we have these false beliefs is partly because of the way our memory represents these successions of experiences. Okay, so second-order projectivism appeals to the beliefs of the perceiver, or inclinations or tendencies to beliefs. And memory is needed. The memory of the succession of experiences accounts for the fact we have these beliefs about, we think we have experiences of succession. But we don't. And so the inclination to believe is based on the memory of the succession of non-simultaneous experiences and the memory of the order in which these experiences arise and the memory of the duration of each experience and of the duration of the whole sequence of experiences. And that's what might base our false beliefs, but that's why we need an appeal to memory, not to account for the phenomenology, but to account for our mistaken beliefs about the phenomenology. Okay. So in very broad lines, that's the way I think the simple account should be defended. And if that works, then the other guys, the constructivist, or the guys I call constructivist, should try to find a different way to motivate their views, not just by showing what goes wrong with the simple-minded account. Okay, so according to the simple-minded account, we don't in fact have experiences of temporal properties. What's so bad about that? You might have thought, well, it's bad because we think we have experience of temporal order because on this basis we can have beliefs and knowledge about temporal order. The picture usually goes, you have an experience representing the fact that P, and that gives you a reason and justification to believe and then know maybe that P. But if this view is true, we don't have that, because we don't have experiences. We don't have any experience representing temporal succession. But as I pointed out, this kind of projectivism only says we have false beliefs about our experiences. It doesn't commit you to thinking that you have false beliefs about the world. So it might be that there's a story to be told about how having a succession of experiences and having memory of this succession gives you justification for believing there's been a succession of events out there in the world. Okay. Secondly, given the dilemma I started with, the way in which the problem is supposed to arise, there's a sense in which going for the simple account, the simple account is just better off than the other accounts, because at least it doesn't commit you to incoherent contents. So, you know, you might think it's bad enough to have massive misrepresentation in experience, but it seems to be less bad than having completely incoherent contents. Okay. Notice that, in principle, there's nothing wrong with saying that experiences are incoherent. There's a couple of different views in the philosophy of perception which might commit you to saying something like this. There's arguments, for example, that if you think that the content of experience is indeterminate in the way it represents numbers, you're going to get incoherent contents. And maybe that's the way it is. The problem is not that this is completely unacceptable. The problem is that experience don't seem to be incoherent. Experience of temporal succession don't seem to be incoherent. So maybe the other guy has to say, we can bite the bullet. Contents of experience are incoherent. We just don't notice that they are. But then it turns out there's this kind of second-order projectivism about this view too, because we just don't have access to certain properties of the contents of our experiences, the fact that their contents of temporal experiences are incoherent. And that's it, and I couldn't resist.
Into the world. And I take it that you think that, you know, much of what actually explains what we take to be phenomenology is actual projective representation. So you might be inclined now to say that, okay, well, we can just regenerate the dilemma for your account on the notion of projective representation rather than phenomenal representation. As when we objectively represent something sort of in this quasi-perceptual way, then we projectively represent it as happening presently and so on for the other cases. Now, I take it that on your account, what you're going to end up doing is denying, I think you must end up denying the analog of the presentness for a projective representation. I think we projectively, when I experience succession, I don't presumably represent them all, projectively represent them all as being present. But as one's happening now, and one is happening a second ago, or some such. But it occurs to me that it seems to me that your account, in some sense, your account and the original phenomenal account have got to be on a par with respect. I mean, the key premise of that. In the argument, seem to be presentness, and that is certainly the one which I was thinking that, you know, even an ordinary perceptual representation would be inclined to deny. Yep. He said, I mean, my natural move is to say that you don't represent everything that's happening right now; we represent things perceptually as happening roughly now, and so within a species present.
Yep.
But in any case, what's the support for that? The support for that premise, I take it, must come from something like phenomenology. But if the support comes from, I don't know what support, but if it was coming from phenomenology, it would equally affect. Would equally arise as a problem for your account, because your account is projective representation is what goes along with
right.
apparent phenomenology.
I'm not sure. So you're right about the first point. So remember, the kind of projectivism at play seems to be a second order. So it's really, the projection is really something to do with the contents of beliefs that people have about their experiences, if they have such beliefs. And it's granting that we have these intuitions, we experience succession of events, that we have experiences representing these successions. So we have false beliefs about that. And it might turn out, you're right, the dilemma, in fact, arises again, and these beliefs are not just false, but they're also incoherent. I don't think that's really a bad thing. Yeah, it could turn out that thing. Yeah. These beliefs are really bad. They're worse than we thought.
So incoherent experience is bad, incoherent beliefs, fine?
Well, you know, they're massively false in the first place, so, you know, being incoherent doesn't really add Well, for one thing. The second thing, I wasn't quite sure what you meant about phenomenology and the other assumptions, but I take it the point about beliefs that they don't need to, the matching assumption is not going to hold about them. You don't need to think that the beliefs vary with the succession of events out there in the world. You don't have to think that's the case. It may be, but it may not be. Maybe memory varies in a way. I'm not sure how to account for memory in these three years. A couple of models you could use, so you could think that memory is very much like the experience. You have just tiny sort of, you know, what you have is a succession of memories, and each memory represents a single experience. Or you might think that memory's duration has duration, and just a slice of memory represents a succession of experiences. And then maybe you have to worry about that. I'm not too sure.
So you might have thought that whatever, one way of reading your model is whatever the previous person said before was, you know, the standard representationalist
right.
with, you know, representations of time, uh-huh. was representative of experience.
Yeah.
You're going to have now have representative to say that extra stuff, some of the extra stuff about representation of succession
yeah.
isn't representative in experience, just representative in belief.
Right.
But otherwise,
right.
your story about the dynamics of representation is going to be more or less isomorphic. The story of the previous person.
So you think so? At what level?
What explains the apparent phenomenology isn't the actual phenomenal conceptual state of the belief. But now you're saying that you might deny?
No, what's dynamical is the succession of experiences, that's true. Mm-hmm. But I don't think at the level of beliefs, how we explain our false beliefs about the experiences, there needs to be anything that's dynamic itself. You just end up with a belief, there was an experience of succession.
I actually think that the projection itself is something that goes on moment to moment.
Oh, I see.
It's like we're doing sort of moments of cool philosophical reflection. We just take
I said, the beliefs might be more like inclinations to believe, because it seems completely implausible that people always have these beliefs and, you know, consciously believing, I'm having an experience. Okay, so that shouldn't happen. So there's a question of how implicit they are, what does that mean? And I don't really know. Yeah, so that's a good point. So, of course, so if you want to fully develop the account, you want to make sure that you don't go for sort of fully conscious beliefs changing as the events go along. Yeah, you don't want that.
Then the other part of the question was, so why is it so bad to deny, just for the original person, to deny presentness and say that things just happen in the species present?
It seems that, they can. As I said, that was one move. You could just deny any of these. You could also deny the individuation assumptions, I take it. You could say, there's a kind of threshold. You know, when the experiences sort of happen, you know, there's a couple of hours in between the experiences, we think that's different token experiences, but when there are really microseconds in between, we just don't want to individuate tokens like that.
The question was, what's the support for prisoners?
Well, it looks like that's quite intuitive, that when you do a bit of phenomenology, there's a sense in which any event that's represented seems to be represented as being present.
It seems to be kind of present. It seems to be having sort of around now, but that seems to be compatible with, a notion of the...
Okay, so, right. At least this is true. You're going to, whatever move you make in response to that dilemma, you're going to have to, one way in which you can go is to deny one of the assumptions, and then you have to explain why you want to deny and when it's false. So I take it the special present guy have to give, quite strong reasons to think that it is false, because it seems to be, in a way, a default assumption. We seem to think that we do experience. There's a lot of phenomenological evidence to think that we experience things as presents. Maybe it's not conclusive, but then there's an argument to be had about that.
So I noticed in the last conference a kind of favoritism, in favor of the people at the bottom of the auditorium. So I'm going to go a little bit to the back there to promote justice. DBM.
I'm wondering if you can rescue most of the assumptions at the beginning by making them true of different things, explaining the what goes wrong as being the confused assumption going through the same thing.
Sorry, which assumption? Which assumption?
The whole string assumption.
Right.
So suppose you've got something like your little guy story. You've got, say, three events.
Yep.
Might be that what goes on is that you firstly do get three experiences at three times.
Mm-hmm.
But then in addition, at some point, you get at a single time another experience, which is compiled out of memories of the previous one that were all glued together. And the single experience does indeed represent succession, but that experience is simultaneous. On the other hand, there were three distinct experiences, and they were appropriately at different times. And then the confusion is you have your experience of the succession, and then you somehow think that you're getting it from the three experiences. You're not. You do have the three experiences. When you contemplate on the memory of the three experiences, you're right in thinking that there are three experiences at different times that represented the parts of the experience. But representation of succession doesn't come from that. It comes from the conjoined, simultaneous representation of succession.
Right, so you have four experiences, three of which are perceptual experiences, and the last one is a memory experience of a certain kind. And that might be the way, in fact, I should work out the account to explain how we have these false beliefs. That's a possible view, but then, you know, you have to be careful because maybe it turns out that the memory itself has incoherent contents. The sort of worries that Dave just mentioned. The worries might arise about the contents of beliefs, but they might arise about the contents of memory experiences too.
Well, one way of thinking of a memory experience is that it's actually a representation of the representation we've already got.
Right.
So it's a memory representation.
And so the first phenomenological claim I had, the matching claim, may not be true about the memory experience.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
But you can see there is a thing which it is true.
Right.
That's where the confusion comes in.
No, I think that's right. The memory is going to have to play a role in explaining why we have these beliefs, so... And maybe the way you sketch it would be the simplest way to go. Yep.
Leon?
That wasn't clear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering, why not go for a really simple-minded account? One which, I think there to be a difference between the kind of error that you have with the blind spot.
Right.
And the difference is that with the blind spot error, there's a kind of a compulsion to believe that there's a unity of experience, there's no gap. I don't think there's actually a compulsion to believe that there's a succession of experience. I think we just falsely infer on the basis of correctly representing the world as having a succession of events.
Uh-huh.
And we falsely infer that there is a representation of
Right, but you said there's a successful representation of the succession of events. What state represents that? If not the experience, the belief, right? Okay, right. That's. I mean, I should have been a bit more explicit about this, but there was something iffy in the talk that you assume that there's a strong intuition that we have experiences of succession. I'm not so sure. I agree that maybe it was just a mistake to think that, and there's no compulsion to think that that's the case. And you're right, there's differences between what we want to say about the blind spot case and the succession of experience cases. For one thing, there's no dispute, I take it, in the blind spot literature about the phenomenology. There's no dispute that there is no gap in the experience. Everyone agrees with that. The question is how to explain that. I'm not so sure that's what you're saying is really different from the account I put forward. Because the point of the projectivist account is simply to explain why we end up with these false beliefs. Whatever the phenomenology of these beliefs might be, are they sort of really strong inclinations to have a belief or just inferential mistakes we make?
Well, these kind of projectivist accounts suggest that there is a compulsion.
Okay, all right, I see.
Okay, Craig, you're right in the middle, so I can't go wrong.
I really liked your talk. I didn't have a question about your positive defense of the simple-minded account.
Yeah.
I was a little confused by the dilemma, the motivating dilemma at the beginning. Almost all the assumptions were false. So look at the temporal matching assumption.
Uh-huh.
So that's really three assumptions:
the non-simultaneity,
order, and you could definitely have experiences of things as simultaneous when they're really not simultaneous in the world.
Right.
Of order, things like the flash lag effect, I think, show the order doesn't match the world.
Uh-huh.
The experienced order doesn't match the
world's
order.
Right.
And then duration, I'm not even sure at the level of just sort of ordinary beliefs, even if we believe that. I went to my first opera last night, and it, subjectively speaking, was very, very, very long. I'm not young, I won't complain of not having lived live a long life. But I don't think that shows up in the relativistic space-time metric on my proper time interval. So, for the reasons you mentioned, you might question the individuation.
Yeah.
And some of the other questions about the presentist.
Yeah.
But you could still you could still just deny that. The dilemma just seems there anyway. I mean, maybe if some of our beliefs turn out to be.
I was just trying too hard to make it more interesting than it is. Okay.
But you could still have a simple-minded kind of could still be true.
Of course. Yeah. So a couple of things. The first point about the flashlight cases. So the claim is not that the matching assumption is true of any possible experience.
Is it supposed to be in general or sort of?
No, it's just that these sorts of experiences, the easy cases we focused upon, it seems to be true about those cases, like the clear succession of three events. In that case, that seems quite true. But there may be.
Can you put the assumptions back on the screen?
No, I'm not going to show them. It might be that I've put some quantifiers where I shouldn't have. In the way I stated the.
There wasn't meant to be a sting in the tail.
Isn't there always? Now you're really frightened. You see how many slides I had.
77.
Where am I? That's the short version. Where was that? No, later. Huh? Yes. Getting there. The first one you want?
Sure.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so this was supposed to be a description of the sort of case I'm focusing on. And you're right, there are many examples where this assumption might not be even appealing, and presumably false. Right, so yeah, grant you that. But it seems to me that in these sorts of cases, in many cases, that seemed quite appealing, that matching assumption.
So then you want to resolve the dilemma by finding something more. I mean, so just if it's just appealingness of.
There's kind of hidden challenge to the specious present guy here, which is to say, if you want to give the specious present account, you have to avoid the. It looks as though these intuitions are plausible in these cases, for one thing. Secondly, they're also quite ubiquitous in literature. Lots of people take them as default assumptions. Not always explicitly, but they seem to. And so if you really want to defend the what I call the non-dependence account or some kind of specious present theory, you have some work to do and explain to us why these intuitions are not that appealing or why they're false. You had a second counterexample.
Just about duration.
Notice in a flashlight case, you said... So there's the phenomenology in such a way, but the event's actually not taking place. There's a word, veridical, with the first bit of the assumption. I was assuming that the experience actually correctly represent the succession of events, and that's when there's matching. But of course, if they're not veridical, one way they can go non-veridical is because the order's changed. Something like that. Yeah. Right.
Alex?
I just wanted to press a point that Dave mentioned as an aside about the presentness assumption. The worry was if experience represented V1 as succeeding V2 and V1 as present and V2 as present, then the content would be coherent. That's not obviously right, and you can see that with some spatial analogies. If I say Philippe is on the left and Dave is on the right, and Philippe is here and Dave is here, that's not a contradiction. So what needs to be argued is that, as it were, the present moment as represented in experience is just the single moment of time.
That's right.
It's temporarily spread out, and that just seems to be entirely up for grabs.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be obvious at all that,
right.
That insofar as experience represents the present moment, it's one individual moment.
Yeah. I'm not sure what's the best way to answer that. But notice there was something going on with the issue as to whether the two events are represented at the same time or not. And I kind of assume that if they are represented at the same time and they're both represented as present, even if it's not part of the content, it should follow whatever part of the content would entail that they're represented as being simultaneous, or they are simultaneous, it follows from that content. If they're represented at the same time, one is represented as being present, the other is being present too. Maybe it's not part of the content, but it should follow that they are, in fact, represented or they are simultaneous. Now, the worry about space is... Maybe I'll try to do the analogy.
Yeah.
So Dave is here and Hugh is here, but that doesn't... And one of them is to the left, the other to the right. There's no contradiction. I take it the assumption that the two events are represented at the same time is something like the way in which the indexical content, the spatial content of the indexical is fixed. So I could say, well, you know, Dave is here, and then Hugh is here, right? And so there's a change in the spatial relations that I have when I say, relative to Hugh or relative to Dave, he's here, okay? Unless I mean here in this room, of course. But then it's not really the analogous to now. It's more or less now, or something like that. Or in the temporal vicinity of this particular event, or something like that. You want the spatial location to be more fine-grained than in order to be rightly analogous to the what people assume to be the
presentness. Well, I was thinking that in experience, it wasn't obvious at all that now, as it were, doesn't work like here.
It's used
to indicate this room, as in Q and
D
are both
okay. Right. So suppose you're idea I take it is suppose the experience has duration and it represents the two events as being present and you represent them at different times. And maybe they overlap a bit.
Represents one as
right, right. But it kind of represents one now and then the other now. It's just that the experience has a certain duration. So you can do the experience can do that. The experience goes from T1 to T2. At T1 it represents even V1 as being now, and at T2 it represents even V2 as being now. And then there's no incoherent content. I agree with you. But then there's the other worry that it turns out, if we have these assumptions about how we individuate experiences, it should turn out, in fact, because there are different contents, we have, in fact, different experiences. That's what's doing the work there at this point.
Hugh.
Thanks for a very nice talk. What I'm interested in is the relation that you see between this sort of model and experimental and theoretical work about how we actually detect motion.
Right, right.
I mean, you've obviously offered us a kind of...
completely a priori account.
A very sort of high-level sort of model where it's a sort of high-level movie-style thing.
Right, right.
We have
yeah.
the discrete things, and then we sort of process them and get the idea of succession. Yeah. Now, I know very little about the actual work on how we do this, but my understanding is that there's a lot of evidence that some of it is very low-level that we have. So our visual system... which are key to detecting motion of certain kinds. So I just wondered if you could comment on that on the extent to which you think this is a realistic model. And if it is a realistic model, then whether it's just a realistic model of some places or whether you think it has some kind of generality.
Right, so, interesting, yeah, that's good. So we know that certain rods in the retina actually react to motion and direction of motion. Yeah. Okay, so what does that show? Well, it depends what sort of assumptions you make about the relation between the neurophysiological processing and the what's in a way the end product, the conscious experience. But you might think, well, isn't that kind of interesting that a single firing of a cell in the retina can actually detect motion? there's not a problem for the specious present guys, because, you know, the experience of motion was given as a reason to think that there's duration, experiences with duration, and yet it seems that the retina itself can detect motion in a single instant. You don't need a succession of firings to detect motion, just a single firing might do that, if that's right. Okay. Then it's going to depend really about how you link the two, the physiological processes and the experience. I don't really know. So I'm not really answering in any...
I think we can make it a little bit more focused using a bit of kind of armchair science. Because is that people have damage of certain kinds and can't process...
Yeah, that's right. Motion illusion case. Yeah, yeah.
So they lose the ability to detect certain kinds of motion.
Right.
The motion of a train.
Right.
Whereas...
So they have the experience... Barry had this slide. That's all they see, in fact, you might think. They see the waterfall in that way. They never feel.
Well, they see a succession of different pictures of the waterfall, but can't see the waterfall.
Right.
Which seems to be some sort of problem for your account. If your account were the right account, then they've got the succession of the individual experiences, but they haven't got they can't see that they constitute a succession of the right account.
I'm not sure. Okay, very good. Yep. So there's different ways in which you can answer that. One way would be, well, for normal subjects, the phenomenology of the succession of experiences is such that this is, you know, you get the normal kind of thing, and then it just turns out that these people have just slightly more gappy experiences, or maybe they're... Maybe, in fact, it turns out they're very phenomenologically sensitive, and they, contrary to us, they notice the gaps. So they just have these sort of tiny temporal slices. That could be one explanation. Or you might think there's something wrong with their memory, and so they have... But the worry, I take it, is that there's really something fundamentally phenomenological that's different in that case. And maybe my account is not able to... Or the simple-minded account, I'm not sure it's my account still, but may not be able to capture that, unless it goes to saying, well, either they're more phenomenologically sensitive, or there's something funny going on in the way they're in the succession of the pace in which the succession of their experiences is taking place, which explains that phenomenological difference. That could be another way to go, I guess. Not so sure, but yeah, good question. Thanks.
Tim, you had a finger on this?
Yeah, I just want to push Hugh's question.
Someone who knows the empirical stuff.
Well, I mean, it was going to be my question as well, but let me push it a little bit further. I mean, it's a little bit difficult, I think, to know exactly what the experience is like for these folks, but here's one possibility. There's no real phenomenal gaps. It's like they see a picture of... So, I mean, one of the cases that's described as a woman trying to cross the road, and it's very difficult because she just sees a series of stills. But it's not as though there's a gap between each...
I see.
Right? I mean, it's like there's going to be looking at a still for a certain period of time, and that flows into another still of the bus being closer, which flows into another still.
Right.
It looks like what's dropped out is the experience of motion as such.
No, you're right.
And
you're right.
It's very tempting to give a representational analysis.
Exactly.
And it looks like you don't want to. So that I take...
Oh, no. So I thought the idea is that what might be going wrong is that... So in our case, we have... There's changes in the content that are very fine-grained. So, you know, you see that the little guy at some spatial location, and then the next experience is just a tiny shift in the location of the little guy. Let's say that's the normal case. Now, it might be that their experiences are kind of representationally more coarse-grained, or there's something going wrong with the representation of space, so that for a while the experiences actually have the same content. They just represent... the location of the little guy at the same place, and then suddenly, tick, there's a massive change in the representational content, and they represent the guy quite far away from where he was. And there's a succession of experiences doing that, and then later on, so that could be a way in which you explain that.
I thought that on your view, there's no representation of motion in visual consciousness. There might be beliefs about
the
relationship between experiences. There might be
that's right.
You might be able to load motion into belief, but not experience. experience.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, but it looks like in what this woman's lost is the experience of motion per se. I take it you're denying that.
Well, yeah, I'm denying that. So there's something like, there's this impression that she's having an experience of succession of certain kinds of events. She has an experience of a succession of a different kind of event. So they kind of, it looks gappy because there's no motion for a while, then trick, quite a change, and then something like that. But in both cases, there's no single experience that represents motion. Yeah.
I'm counting five fingers on this question, so I'm not sure we're going to do all of them, but Hugh should definitely have
right.
some.
I was just going to suggest that there would be quite a simple experiment that we could do to sort of get clear about these things. I mean, we could simply illuminate something like a moving bus with a strobe light.
Yep.
So that for us, it becomes a very discrete series.
Exactly.
Now, my guess is that normally equipped people will still have no trouble seeing it as a moving bus coming towards them. And so making the thing discrete doesn't put us in the situation of these unfortunate people who have this lesion.
Right, but pardon me, on my view that's going to be, well, they still keep the belief that there's a, you know, it might be them. You could trick them. Suppose you also tell them you're taking them in a world where motions, things happen a bit differently in that world, and then you just have a case of motion and with the stroboscopic light. And, you know, what would they think then? Would they kind of be tempted to think, well, maybe that wasn't an experience of motion. Something else was going on. You know, it might just be that they retain their background, their false beliefs about the experience in that case. And you could play around with that too.
Maybe, Philippe, you will decide if you want the next hand or go through some of these fingers. What's your preference?
Well, no, this is quite good stuff. So it's probably a bad worry for the view. So maybe.
So I think the next finger was DBM.
Your answer to Hugh made me a little bit more puzzled about what you said earlier to me.
Uh-huh.
The story there was that we agreed that. Let's say say there are four bus snapshots, right?
Yeah.
So there are four bus representations.
Yeah.
And then in addition, there's at least say a fourth one, which is one which represents the
succession
of via representations of the previous representations, or something like that.
Yeah.
Now that's not guaranteed to be there by logic alone. It's going to be an empirical matter of
fourth
representation appears, and its absence precisely explains the kind of deficit.
No, the worry was that, remember the view says, insofar as the phenomenology is concerned, the phenomenology of these apparently experiences of succession simply supervenes on the phenomenology of succession. And then what's taking place is that we have certain beliefs that we experience succession. And memory explains that. Right, but the worry in this case is that the phenomenology seems to be going wrong with the phenomenology. It's not just that we have false beliefs, but maybe in the second case that Hugh mentioned, there might be something like false beliefs going on. But setting aside the worries that Tim raised about what's the phenomenology of these, you know, the motion blind people, it looks like it's quite plausible to think that there's something phenomenologically different.
Yeah, the suggestion is what's going wrong with phenomenology is that you're mistaking the representations which give you the representations of the movement,
right.
The representations which are the representations of the experiences of the minds. Point is, both of them are there.
Yeah.
So your desiderata are all there, but they're not all meant by the same thing.
Right.
And there is an error. The error is thinking they are meant by the same thing.
Okay, right. Yeah, that'd be... Yeah, I'm not sure. In those cases, I'm not sure what's the best, just to go for... Something funny going on with the contents of the experiences and the way they succeed, there's sort of massive shifts in the contents of experiences, and then there's similarity for quite a while, and then that could be one explanation. Or you also appeal to memory, and I'm not sure what's the best way to. And partly, I suspect, it's going to depend on how we describe the phenomenology of their experiences.
But it could not be near memory, right? It's that something genuinely created out of the memories, and that's what doesn't happen.
Right, okay, right. Yeah.
Dave, you have the finger on this.
I don't see why you have to deny that there's experience of motion. I mean, you deny there's experience of a certain kind of succession, but it seems to be perfectly consistent with your picture to say that at any given time, you represent an object as being in a certain location and as moving in a
that's,
certain
that's
direction.
That's true, sorry.
That happens over time. Then what do you say about these deficits as they involve some deficits with respect to the instantaneous representation.
Right. That's still open here. Yeah. Unless you plug in assumptions about, experience of motion, some kind of phenomenological matching assumptions, this would be true about that, and then you get where again.
Yeah. In the blue shirt, I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Is this a finger?
Peter.
Or
it's just a finger.
Peter.
Sorry.
Actually, I'm referring to the blue shirt.
Green shirt. Sorry,
Peter. Yeah. Is that a finger or a hand?
Yeah, I think a really important thing, perception of time is the perception of duration and tempo.
Uh-huh.
So I was wondering if you could talk to that. And also, it relates to the way in which you've chosen to not explore the idea of an internal clock at all. Yet that may be necessary for us having a perception of the duration of time. And we're also perhaps providing
right.
an alternate explanation.
So, could quite a few people, and Lev Hedevin in particular, appeals to internal clocks to explain. Of time. So on the simple-minded count, you don't experience duration as such. What seems to be an experience of duration is just the duration of experiences. And then there's a question of how do you get access to the fact that there's certain temporal length to that duration. And it might be there's an internal clock playing some role in there. And the question is, what kind of mental state is the sort of locus of that internal clock doing some role? And presumably memory is going to be. Maybe memory comes with. It's in virtue of these internal clocks that memory remembers the succession of experiences as having a certain duration, a certain order, and that sort of thing. That would be impossible. But you're right. That's going to be probably a necessary element of the account.
So the last finger on this is mine.
Uh-huh.
I think it's fair to say that the difference between normal experience and the experience of the motion-blind patient is accounted for very straightforwardly by the anti-projectivist and is accounted in a very convoluted way by the projectivist. So I think it's a major disadvantage. Now, it might be, for the projectivist, now it might be that this disadvantage is outweighed by certain advantages, but I think it's clear that there's a major liability here.
Right, so I don't see how the anti-projectivist is going to account for the experience. They can say, well, they don't have, long experiences with that content. But what's the positive account?
Normal people have experience of succession.
Uh-huh.
They don't.
Well, but what's the positive account of their experiences?
Whose?
Of these, the motion-blind people.
They have succession. They only have succession of experiences. They don't have experiences of succession.
Oh, I see. I would have thought that they could have... Right.
But you... avail yourself of this because you say the normal patient, the normal people also have only succession of experiences.
Well, so you think the move to say, there's something going on with the content. So you have a succession of experiences with exactly the same content for a while, and then there's another succession of experience with a bit more different content, and they have the same content for a while, and then that's implausible?
Convoluted.
Really?
No.
Well, I don't see. Nothing else.
Okay. Doug has been waiting very patiently.
Just skip me. Someone else has a better question.
I think Greg had a question. Yes.
Yeah. It was basically about the question of plausibility of a belief about belief without experience.
Uh-huh.
And I suppose one way I could put it is in terms of non-conceptual content, although by doing that, I don't want to say that I'm committed to non-conceptual content, and so therefore...
Nothing wrong with that.
It's rather just as a handle to get off. But in other words, the tremendous, the denseness of it, the fact that you may experience succession without having some of the concepts that might be needed to articulate beliefs at any rate,
mm-hmm.
consciously about what succeeded what, because mm-hmm. it's all a bit of a blur and so forth. So that if you think of as well, the non-conceptual content problem, if you like, in other areas of perception,
uh-huh.
Then if you plug it in here to the experience of succession, it looks as though you have a similar kind of problem. So that just relates to the plausibility of a belief without experience account in this area.
So I'm not sure I followed. there's a worry, there's a general motivation for getting non-conceptualists, which is that creatures seem to have certain experiences, but it seems plausible to think that they lack certain concepts which you would need to specify the content of these experiences. So where in particular do you think that worry arises here with the simple-minded account?
Well, insofar as you put it, if you put it in the case of creatures like that, then they are able to respond to a succession of events in a way that in a very smooth way, etc. In a way that that seems to be like how they respond successfully to the conceptual cases.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Remember, I said that. Okay, so good. I should have been a bit more explicit again. It was iffy. There's a fairly sophisticated intuition people have, or sophisticated people who do phenomenology have this intuition that we have experiences of succession. And we need to answer that. The projectivist account says, well, the way to answer that is we have false beliefs about experiences. But that it doesn't follow from this we have false beliefs about the world. And that doesn't block... I didn't give you any story, but you might think that the way David did it is the right way. So you have a succession of experiences, you have memory, and that gives rise to a belief that there's been a succession of events. And so it's not just the belief about the world is not just based on the merely on the experiences, but also on the memory of the succession of experiences. And that gives you, whatever the nature of the content of that memory is, that gives you an account of how people or creatures can... react successfully to succession of events. You don't need to... I don't see where there's going to be a problem about that. I mean, I'm only sort of positing... If you think that certain creatures have these beliefs that we have experiences of succession, presumably quite sophisticated creatures have these beliefs, then we need an account of that. But that's what I provided.
It's not so much that they have beliefs about succession, experiences of succession, but rather that maybe the best explanation of how they perform,
uh-huh.
that they actually have experiences of succession.
Oh, I see. And we don't...
That they're actually not conceptually equipped.
Oh, I see.
Beliefs.
I see.
Of succession to explain their success. Yeah,
right. So the... Okay, right. So the move is... the worry is this. Sometimes in this literature on non-conceptual content, there's an assumption that we need non-conceptual content because we need to explain behavior without appealing to... there's a sense in which the perception is quite closely connected to action in a way that you don't need beliefs to be an intermediate between perception and action. Because beliefs would require a complex concept these creatures don't have, so we can just go straight from perception. And if that's the case, then how can we explain the fact that these creatures can act as if they are succession of events if they don't have beliefs? And false beliefs about the fact that there's been a succession. Well, what about memory? You might think that the memory that David was talking about, a memory of a succession of... experiences and a succession of representing a succession of event is non-conceptual, and that's what gives you the link to. It's on the basis of that they're able to react to succession of events in the appropriate way. That would be one obvious way to go. I take it.
It just seems implausible that if a bird is diving on prey and successful, the prey is running. Bounce was in exactly the right place at the right time, and so on. If you were trying to explain, many other things about a creature's success,
mm-hmm.
in general terms of perception, not the perception of succession, but just in general terms of perception. If that's the way you do it in all these other cases, it just looks intuitively at first sight as though you would be thinking that the bird is experiencing the succession, the motion of the prey.
Uh-huh.
And it's tracking it. And it's
Well, there's a sense in which that's true. I mean, it's tracking it by having a succession of events that correctly represents each event in a succession. By having a succession of experiences, each experiences in the succession of experiences correctly represent the particular location of the event, and the succession of experiences matches in the appropriate way the succession of events. That's how tracking takes place. You don't have, if that's true, you don't have to have, you know, one experience representing the temporal relations between the events.
We've gone over time, so let's thank Philippe.